Good morning, everybody. Do the children need to be invited out for... No, not today. All right. Oh, that's good. You get to listen to me, too. Good morning. My name's Ed. Thanks for the introduction. I mean, what a privilege to follow that. And I think what genuinely that was fits in, I think, with what I'm hoping to bring this morning to encourage you with, which is Psalm 74, the psalm that was read earlier. Just some introduction, because not all of you know me. My name's Ed. I'm from the UK. You can probably hear my accent. I've been coming to Trinity. We've been coming as a family to Trinity for a year and a half, getting on for 2 years now. This is my wife, Jen, long-suffering, very patient wife and daughter, Alice. It's a real privilege to have the opportunity to talk. So thank you very much. Bit of a risk, perhaps, Rob. I don't know, but thank you for taking that risk. I really value it, and I count it an honour. So Psalm 74. It's quite a bleak psalm. Comes right in the middle of the Psalter, the 150 psalms. So you're pretty much bang in the middle of Psalm 74, and it kicks off with this question: why? Why have you rejected us forever? And if you've got the notice sheet, you'll see that I've entitled this whole talk, "I Don't Get It." You know, there's lots of confusion, I think, often in being a Christian. But I'd like to start at the start. My day job is I work as a counselor in a prison, doing drug and alcohol counseling, mainly in groups. So you might see some of that flavor coming through, because group work, you know, it involves interaction and participation. And so what I'd like to do is just get a couple of people to just let me know how long they've been a Christian for, and can they remember what it was like when they first became a Christian? Maybe, what would we say, some emotion words. So was there kind of joy? Was there excitement? You know, I won't give all the words away. I warned Ian. So we'll start with, how long have you been a Christian for, Ian?
I became a Christian in
69.
I don't know how long that is.
Yeah, that's a while, eh?
Yeah.
And do you remember what it felt like? Do you remember that? I mean, some people have a road to Damascus type experience like Paul, and others it's more of a kind of gradual, I realize something's changed in me. What was it like for you?
I had a serious build-up to my conversion for about 8 months, and just little by little over that 8 month time slot, God just slowly broke down barriers in my heart. And I remember the night I became a Christian, I was living in a hostel where I was working, a men's hostel. And I'd been at a Christian conference in Auckland. This is in Hamilton. I'd been in a Christian conference in Auckland. And literally it felt like I couldn't get home quick enough to get on my knees. To get my heart to God. Yeah. I couldn't get home quick enough.
Yeah, thank you. And obviously, you know, just the emotion is still there. And just all of you, if you're a believer, if you count yourself a Christian in the room, just please consider, you know, that moment that for Ian that he described for him. Consider it. Cast your mind back, kind of relive it, enjoy it. For me, I became a Christian 11 years ago now. It's 2001. Just that sense of excitement for what life had to hold, because what I thought life was going to be like was this, ABCD. And now I discovered, actually, that my whole purpose, my whole foundation had shifted to something just way bigger than me, way more exciting. And knowing that my sin was forgiven was a very liberating experience. So, yeah, we don't have time to get more feedback, but just remember that for yourself, because it's an important thing to carry. Why? Why is it an important thing to carry? Well, because it's going to get tough. It's going to get hard down the road, as Janina has recently experienced, and no doubt people in this room are currently experiencing. Just that excitement turns to, oh my goodness, I didn't realize it would be this hard. And in Psalm 74, you've really got an expression of that. It's a guy called Asaph, and he's writing at a time in Israel's history when, you know, they've had the glory days. They've had the Red Sea. They've had the fire of God's fire burning, that pillar of fire burning through the night and leading them through the wilderness, the raining of the down of the food. They've had that exciting provision, and they've had the rules of David and Solomon where their empire was as big as it's ever been. They've had the success, kind of politically, if you like. And suddenly, things start declining, and the Assyrians batter the north of Israel. So that whole kingdom goes, and you've really only just got kind of the core left, which is Jerusalem. The Assyrians didn't quite get that far. But the Babylonians, under King Nebuchadnezzar, managed to just destroy the place. They just decimate it and scatter the people of Israel left, right, and center. A lot of them end up in Babylon. You know, that's where David does his thing. Not David, Daniel. And so this is a psalm written during that period. And you can imagine having come from that glory and then found themselves in this place of just defeat, just utterly demoralizing. And the question, why have you rejected us forever? It just seems really a natural question to ask under such circumstances. Just a little point, we're going to be kind of jumping from Israel's experience into our own experience in the present, and I think from how I understand the Bible, that's something that we're expected to do, that what happens as Israel goes through the journey out of Egypt into the Promised Land is a picture, a mirror, ultimately of the rescue that Jesus brought when he came down to earth as God. And it's a picture of our rescue, that we have been purchased from slavery and brought through the waters and baptism and into a promised land of life with his spirit living within us. So I will make that transition back and forth as we go a little bit. And one of the things that people, a little bugbear, one of the things that people sometimes say is that, you know, the God of the Old Testament is different from the God of the New Testament, that somehow he had a personality kind of switch around and decided that, I've been a bit mean, so I need to start being nice. And that's not a faithful picture of who God is. God is consistent. He does not change. The God that they experienced and worshipped is the same God, exactly the same God that we look to this morning. And so I wanted to throw that in because I think it's important to have in there. I think it's relevant. And so we find ourselves in 15th of April 2012, and many of us are struggling. And the question why, I think, is a natural question to ask, especially when you consider the glory within which we started. Couldn't get home fast enough to get on our knees. And it might be that you're feeling neglected by God, that in those days where you were so nurtured, you sit in your chair this morning and think, where are you? So that's the first half of the psalm, really. Not the first half, the first section. And I break it into five sections. It works as a symmetrical psalm. So the first section is an appeal. And it's verse 2, to remember the nation that you purchased long ago. To remember us. Why are you letting this happen? Don't forget us. Remember what you did. Remember me now. The people of your inheritance, turn your steps towards these everlasting ruins. And so that's the appeal that we start with. And then we look back at actually what went wrong. How did things come to this? And that's verses 4 to 9. And I'll just read them through. They're quite shocking verses. Your foes roared in the place where you met us. They set up their standards as signs. They behaved like men wielding axes and cut through a thicket of trees. So they really destroyed the nation. But the next bit's really insult to injury. They smashed the carved paneling with their axes and hatchets. And if you've read your Leviticus, there's a detailed description of how they were to build the temple of God. There was some carved paneling in there, so that's what that refers to. God went to the effort of giving them these detailed instructions. They went to the effort of building it, and suddenly it's all destroyed. They burned your sanctuary to the ground, verse 7. They defiled the dwelling place of your name. So not only did they destroy it, they disrespected it. They defiled it. They did things that shouldn't be done in the holy place. They said in their hearts, we will crush them completely. They burned every place where God was worshipped in the land. So you can see the focus on the religion, their faith, their relationship with God, where God lived among them. That was what was crushed. And that is the hardest pill to swallow. So how might that apply to us? Well, where does God dwell in the land? He dwells in our churches. He lives among us in our congregations. And church isn't what you might hope. I don't care how much of an optimist you are. And I'm not saying there's not wonderful things going on. But really, when you think about the God who created the sun, the moon, the stars, who separated the light from the dark, and when you look at what church is in New Zealand, in the UK where I'm from, I can't see a similarity. You've got persecution from the outside. And persecution oftentimes has an effect. It weakens the church. I'm quite interested in North Korea, and I've been following them a bit in the news. But that's one of the countries in the world that has the greatest persecution against Christians. And there is a church there, and it's a really exciting thing to read about and know what God is doing in there. But at the same time, there's people who've never heard the gospel because of the extent to which Christianity has been crushed in that place. So you just wonder why. You know, why would God allow the church to be impacted? Then you've got division from within. So again, a hard pill to swallow. It's not just non-believers threatening the church, but believers between themselves can't seem to get on. We can't seem to agree, and churches fall by the week. For petty reasons often, you know, like what type of music should be played and which leader is more charismatic and all those kind of things. And you think, why? Why are you allowing this to happen to your church, to the very thing that carries your glory? Not enough laborers. There's another thing I put down on my list. You know, why, when we call for sort of an evangelistic event, do we not get everybody in attendance or anything like? Why, when the opportunities are there, are people not taking them? And I speak for myself. There's not enough laborers here, and I think there are some people in this church that feel that really keenly. There's so much harvest, there's so much that could be done, and it's a relatively easy thing, especially in Takanini, and yet there's not enough people. And finally, you know, when we narrow it down to your life and your experience, you want to come to church and there are forces at work that are stopping you. Maybe financial, you've got to work. Maybe you're being oppressed in some way and someone's stopping you from coming. Maybe you're being allowed to come, but when you come, it comes at a price. Abuse in all its forms. And you think, well, God should make this bit easy, at least. Okay, I can understand Monday to Friday, but you should allow me to come to church, you know? Give me a break on this day. So it's the very heart of where God dwells that's the thing that's defiled. That was Israel's experience. The sanctuary was burnt to the ground. But I think in part it's our experience too. And so we call, I don't get it. Why are you allowing this to happen? So that is the second section, which is a reminder of what went wrong. We started with an appeal. You know, remember us. Where are you? Second section is a reminder. The third section is an appeal too. And this is right at the heart, the center of the psalm. And often in the Bible, when you have these, they're called chiastic structures, which basically means you've got this symmetry. The middle bit is the emphasis. That they didn't have Microsoft Word, so they couldn't do bold font and all that kind of stuff. But they could structure their writings in such a way as to show where they want the reader to concentrate. So this section is a really important section for the writer Asaph and for us too. And it's verses 10 and 11. It's an appeal again. And it's a pretty brutal appeal to destroy them, to take away the barriers. It says, how long will the enemy mock you, God? Will the foe revile your name forever? Why hold back your hand, your right hand, which is his hand of judgment? Take it from the folds of your garment and destroy them. Make it stop, I think, is really the cry. Make it stop. Give me some peace. If only so I can come to church and worship. And I think that's a fair thing to ask. It's probably the bleakest section of the psalm too, because there's a note of desperation to it. The end of verse 9, there's this idea, none of us know how long this will be. It says there, nobody quite knows how long this is going to happen for. And that's really the two kind of fold questioning towards God in this psalm. Is the first question is, why are you allowing this to happen? And the second question is, how long is it going to continue for? And so this cry is, just make it stop. I need it to end now. Otherwise, I just don't know whether I can keep going. And so we move into the fourth section, which is another reminder, verses 12 to 17. And this starts to give us some perspective. This is an opportunity, I suppose, to zoom out and remember who God is. Verse 12, but my God is my king from long ago. He brings salvation to the earth. It was you who split open the sea by your power. You broke the heads of the monsters in the water. Referring, I imagine, to the Red Sea, the sea that Janina described. It was you who opened up springs and streams. You dried the ever-flowing rivers. The day is yours, the night is yours also. You established the sun and the moon. I was looking at the sky this morning and there was, you could see the moon just at around 9:30 in the sky, just not far off from the sun, so I could see them both. And just trying to remember that the God that we worship here this morning is the same God that set those things in place, those things that we've can barely understand, that we've had a man on the moon at least, but it inspires awe. And then we come, you know, to the rest of the universe, the stars. It was you who set the boundaries of the earth. You made both summer and winter. And so the first hint of an answer, I suppose, to those questions, why are you allowing this to happen? And how long is it going to be carrying on for? Comes in this section. God is God. So he created all things. But two, he brought you salvation. That's there in verse 12. My God is God from King from long ago. He brings salvation on the earth. And so he too, just as he created the earth, he created life in you. And you can read these verses 13 to 17 slightly differently, I suppose, when you apply them to your own conversion, that moment where you became a believer. He split open the sea by his power. You were brought through water in baptism. As the water closed, your sin was crushed, just as the Egyptian army was, and you were brought through into a new life. It was you who crushed the heads of the Leviathan and gave food to the creatures of the desert. Your sin forgotten. It was you who opened up the springs and streams. He put his spirit in your heart, which Jesus describes as an ever-flowing spring of living water. So he's opened up springs and streams in us too. And he's given us days and nights, one after the other, to the point where we've got enough to be sitting in these chairs here. God has, in you, done a wonderful, miraculous thing on a par with putting the stars in the sky. He's brought you from death to life, and he's set his heart in you. So that's what God's done. That's what we need to remember when we're faced with these two questions. We need to cast our minds back to the moment when we were rescued and remember that spring that he put in our hearts and rejoice in it. But it doesn't quite answer these questions, does it? Why and for how long? I mean, it starts to give us some hope, but it doesn't quite answer them. And I guess we have to live with that. That's what Job had to live through in Job. He was just given a glimpse of God, and that was enough. We have to trust that God has his reasons. But there is another hope, I think, in this psalm, in the final section, which is verses 18 to 23, which is an appeal again to vindicate yourself. And as I read this section, just I'll emphasize how many yous and yours there are in it, because the yous and yours are a good thing. We need them. I'll explain why once we've got to the end. Remember, verse 18, how the enemy has mocked you, how foolish people have reviled your name. Do not hand over the life of your dove to the wild beasts. Do not forget the lives of your afflicted people forever. Have regard for your covenants, because haunts of violence fill the dark places of the land. Do not let the oppressed retreat in disgrace. May the poor praise your name. The poor and needy praise your name. Rise up, O God, and defend your cause. Remember how fools mock you all day long. Do not ignore the clamor of your adversaries, the uproar of your enemies, which rises continually. Okay, so the good news in all of this is God is bigger than you and I. He's bigger than Trinity. He's bigger than the global church. And he will ultimately have regard for his name before all things. And he's not going to allow himself to be defiled when it comes down to it. He will come through, not because we're good enough or because we've impressed him enough, but because he cares for his name, because he's made promises that he has to see through, which is a great relief. So as you look around and you see weakness in your own life, in your church, be grateful that God coming through doesn't depend on those things. But still we're left with this question, but did you have to do this? I mean, I understand what Ed's saying and everything, but why did you allow this to happen in my life? I mean, surely that was a step too far. And here really is where I want to talk about faith. And really the big application of this whole passage as I understood it. Because Asaph was a man who'd experienced, you know, he was a leader of the church, and under his watch, he'd seen the whole thing crumble. He'd seen it defiled. And he still took the time to sit down and write the psalm. He didn't go down to the brothel or the casino and just say, ah, whatever, I've had enough of this. He sat down and he wrote this psalm. And I think, you know, it's an appropriate response for us too, to come before God and say, okay, I see what you're doing. I don't understand it. Why are you doing this? I don't know. How long is it going to be for? I don't know. But I know who you are, and I'm thankful for who you are. And I know that you will come through because you care about your name. And I think that's just a really wonderful act of faith. That's, I think, what we're called to do in these times. It's not to have a breakthrough, but it's to just keep going. So we ask those questions in our prayer, and that's appropriate. Faith isn't a big fixed smile and, oh, it'll all be good because, you know, I trust God's going to come through. That's not Asaph's experience. It's that broken kind of cry of despair that comes from his gut and pours out in some kind of primeval yell. And that's appropriate. That's what we're asked to do too. We're not supposed to get it, just to know that God is God, and that faith isn't that smile, it's perseverance. It's sticking to it, even when we don't understand. So that is the call, that is the challenge. One of the things when I'm at work that often you find, especially among people who've had drug and alcohol addictions, is that the emotions are the things that people make their decisions around. So if I'm feeling this way, I'm pretty sure that I should go and do it. And emotions are the things that determine whether or not you're going to go back to old behaviors, to relapse, and to other kind of really unhealthy patterns of being. And as Christians, and as people, as we teach in the prison, if you live by your emotions, you know, you're setting yourself up to fail. Because your emotions are like the ocean. They just toss back and forth, and you wake up one day and you feel great, and you wake up the next day and you feel awful. And they have a very important role and place in our lives, but they do not determine truth. God's word determines truth. This is what we come back to. This is what we hold on those days where we just don't understand and we're just feeling wretched. Satan, it's his biggest weapon, really. Emotion. He uses it to pull you from God. Faith is saying, okay, I might feel this way, but I won't allow it to distort my idea of what's true. Because there's some things we do know. And we're very lucky as we sit here this morning, much more lucky than Asaph was, because we live the other side of the cross. Asaph, he lived before Jesus. He didn't fully know how God would reveal himself. We do, in the sense that we can reflect on the old rugged cross and see the glory in it. And we can know, when we look at the cross, that Jesus' work won't be in vain, that what he's done is lasting and it's ultimately powerful. It's enough. It gives us a freedom from sin, past sin, present sin, future sin. It gives us a confidence in heaven. If you're a Christian here this morning, if you've just put your faith in Jesus, you're going to heaven. You don't need to. You don't need to freak out because you made a mistake. You just need to keep looking to Jesus. That's all we need to do. And we have this wonderful history of God coming to earth to reflect on. And it can give us that hope. But two, we have what Asaph had, which is creation. Yeah, we have the stars and the moon and the sun and the sky. And even though we might feel small and God might feel like he's dropped the ball, you know, they're still floating around up there. And we have our salvation. We have our story. We know that there were times in our life where we couldn't wait to get back home to get on our knees. And though we might not feel like that today, it's there, it's still living within us. The Holy Spirit still dwells within us. That same breakthrough exists within you. It's alive, still. And just as it was being read out by Rory, just that line in verse 21, which I didn't notice when I was preparing the psalm, may the poor and the needy praise your name, just kind of shot out to me that the gospel, that church, it's not supposed to be impressive. You know, God hasn't designed things the way that he's allowed them or he's making them become. For no reason, because he's made a mistake somewhere. It's always supposed to be the poor and the needy, the pathetic, the unimpressive, who stand and praise the name of God. And God has his purposes for that, and ultimately we will see them one day. Because while we don't have an answer to how long, we do know, we do have half an answer. We know not forever. We know that there will be a time when Jesus will return to judge living and the dead. He will establish his kingdom where there'll be no more sorrow. We don't know when it's going to be, but we know that it will happen. And so we can wait. We can be patient, knowing that God will come through. So I was really kind of drawn, as I was looking at this psalm, to that section in Hebrews. Hebrews, a lot of it is about faith. And chapter 11 is a list of people in the Old Testament who just had wonderful faith. You know, starting with Abraham, Moses, working through. And there's some unlikely characters in there too. And there's people who had just horrendous experiences. And so chapter 12 starts, and maybe Mark, I don't know if it'd be possible to get Hebrews chapter 12 I'm going to read verses 1 to 3 out. For time. Therefore, since we're surrounded by such a great crowd of witnesses, you know, speaking of Abraham and Moses and all those guys and girls, since we're surrounded by this great crowd of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders, the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of faith, something that Asaph didn't have. For the joy set before him, he endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who endured such opposition from sinners, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. And as things turned out, Asaph didn't grow weary and lose heart, and God restored the nation, and he restored his glory among those people, and he will do the same here in Takanini, no matter what it might look like today. And while you may daily consider giving up, remember that he will return, that he hasn't forgotten you, that he's got his reasons, and that one day we will picture the old ragged cross and exchange it someday for a crown. Yeah. Thank you.